It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
Ladies and gentlemen,
can I please have your attention? Can you dig it?
Greetings, dear listeners. This is Jonah Goldberg, host of the Remnant Podcast, brought to you by the Dispatch and Dispatch Media. I am talking to you from the 10th floor of the Pendry Hotel in Hudson Yards, New York. I am overlooking a fairly grim, but still cool view. There's something about, as long as you have height, everything looks kind of cool. You can't call it the Lower West Side of Manhattan, but it's the West Side of Manhattan near the Lincoln Tunnel, and I'm right above one of the access roads out of the Lincoln Tunnel, which is ironic given that my mom had a house on the other side of the river with the equivalent road leading away from the Lincoln Tunnel. None of this is particularly interesting. I am just trying to warm up a little bit. It's early. I did CNN last night from here, actually I did two shows, and I lost my temper, but I got a little heated on one of them, weirdly enough. We can talk about that in a little bit. Where to actually begin, though? I kind of feel like everyone is kind of sick of hearing about the indictment stuff with Trump. And if you aren't, you should really listen to the latest episode of Advisory Opinions or the latest episode of the Dispatch podcast, where we get into it with some specificity on both. I think I've had my say on a lot of this stuff. I wrote my LA Times column about this. I just think that the legalification of all of this bothers me. I'm more persuaded than I was at the beginning of the week of some of Sarah's complaints about how outraged we should be about Melvin Bragg. Was there a Melvin Bragg somewhere? Alvin Bragg. She thinks we should be much more outraged about what Bragg is doing because it is essentially lawless than we should be about Trump's behavior or what the Republicans are doing to defend him and all that. And I'm a little bit more persuaded. But not as persuaded as she would like. She keeps talking about how this should be like the Thomas More, Richard Roper speech in A Man for All Seasons, which I actually have written about a bunch of times in the G-File and in my column. I love that scene. I think it's wonderful. This is the scene where Roper accuses, Thomas More of wanting to give the devil the benefit of the law, and Moore has this great thing about it. He says, absolutely, I do, because you would want to clear the entire nation of forests of law. It's a good metaphor, but I can't remember exactly how he does it. Falling all the trees of law, leaving this country bare. And then he says, what would you do when the devil wheels round on you and you have no place to hide behind the law because you've cut it all down? I get the point. I get the point a lot because, again, I've brought it up a bunch of times. I don't think, I agree entirely with Sarah. I don't think the stakes are the same, in part because I don't think Trump is the devil. And nor do I think we're cutting down all of the laws to get Trump. And I say we advisedly because I have no say in any of this whatsoever, but it's prompted a ongoing thing between Sarah and I, who I love to argue with and I respect her a lot. Don't tell her that. where she thinks letting the Nazis march in Skokie was the one of the greatest moments in American history. It makes her proud to be an American and all that. And I get the argument, and I don't think there is, I'm not saying there's no merit to it, but I'm a, you've probably been okay, probably shouldn't have let the Nazis march in Skokie guy, and have been for a very long time. And so Sarah and I are going to do either a special paywalled podcast for the Dispatch where we debate the Skokie Nazi thing, or maybe we'll do a special Remnant. I haven't decided, or we haven't decided which, but that should be fun. So anyway, I got nothing more. I mean, I think the only thing I haven't really talked about, which I think is freaking more hilarious than disturbing. I mean, look, I think Trump's his playing footsie with violence now is not deniable. I thought it was an overread of his original first tweet about the protest thing. But only marginally so. But I didn't think you could say, okay, he wants violence because he wants people to protest. But now, like overnight, I guess he tweeted, posted on Truth Social, on his post-truth social media platform, that arresting him would lead to death and destruction, or charging him would lead to death and destruction. Now, that's just a threat, right? He posted a picture of him wielding a baseball bat, sort of like Robert De Niro in The Untouchables, next to a picture of Bragg. That's a threat, right? That's violence. And I don't think he has the capacity to raise the kind of mob violence he did on January 6th. But this is another one of those examples of the difference between necessary and sufficient. All it takes is arousing a couple people or even one person to do terrible things, and you have some moral culpability, even if you don't violate the standard of Times v. Sullivan. Again, this is my problem, where we seem to think you can do evil things, but so long as you don't cross over the very wide safeguards of the law, you cannot be held accountable for it in terms of politics. I think it's just an incredibly pernicious development in American life. This idea that if something is not against the law, no one has a right to judge it or condemn it or to punish people or hold people accountable or make people face consequences for it. Most of the things you punished your kids for, if you have kids, were not illegal. That doesn't mean you were wrong to punish your kids. Most of the time you've had to discipline somebody who works for you. It wasn't because they did something illegal. You're allowed to, but somehow we think because politicians work in politics and work for the government, the thing that applies to them are legal strictures rather than moral and philosophical and common sense strictures, and which is particularly weird since the whole point of elections is to fire people, not for illegal behavior, but just for making bad decisions or just wanting fresh blood. And yet, people lose sight of that all the time. And that's what I've been trying to get at all week with this point about how, you know, whether it's a misdemeanor or whether it's a, it can be sort of bootstrapped into a felony, misses the point that all of this behavior, all of this stuff that Trump does and elicits from friends and foe alike, you know, he brings out the worst versions of a lot of people. Some people say he brings out the worst version of me and that I have Trump derangement syndrome and yada, yada, yada. Fine. Okay. Whatever. It's still the fact that he's distortive and destructive. I mean, this is the one thing that Tucker Carlson clearly got right, is that Trump is a destroyer. I mean, he says that in those texts. And he, you know, he opted to play footsie with that and encourage it rather than do something about it. That's his choice. But Tucker was right in the observation. And you just look at, you know, look, Trump's own lawyer is being dragged in to testify because three judges ruled that the crime fraud exception in this case pierces attorney-client privilege. I mean, Trump just routinely ruins people's careers and reputations. And he also elevates the worst people to have much more prominent roles in American life, you know, than they should. And you shouldn't have to get into an argument about criminal law to say enough already with this guy. You know, I keep thinking back about, you know, I've had friends who had drug problems. I had a brother who had a drug problem. And there's this point that I think a lot of people understand with relatives who are alcoholics, relatives who have other addiction issues, relatives or friends who have, you know, just simple, really chronic bad judgment or impulse control issues, but who may be really good people and you love them, right? And may be well-intentioned. Sort of like, you know, what's his name? The Tom Hulce character in Parenthood, always I felt very poignant because of his relationship with his dad, played by Jason Robards. And I think it's Tom Hulce. He's the guy who played Mozart in that Amadeus movie. And he's always just got a grift, a con, a scheme, a get-rich-quick idea that exhausts his dad. And he's got a gambling issue and a gambling addiction. And anyway, you know these people in your life. If you don't have one of these people in life, maybe you're the kind of person I'm talking about. But at least at one degree of separation, I think most people know these kinds of people. Hunter Biden, perfect example, right? There are these flawed people who you love, who you know there's a better person in there. But at some point, you're just like, it's always something with this guy. Now, with loved ones, with kids, it's really hard to sort of say, and therefore I'm cutting you off or I'm done with you. But with employees, it's much easier, right? It's hard with friends. I've had it happen with friends where you just be like, you know, look, I get it. You have this excuse about how you were mugged and that's why you couldn't help me move or whatever. But it's always something with you. And I can't tell when you're telling the truth and I can't tell when you're lying or a little bit of the truth or whatever. And so at some point you just got to sort of cut bait. And that's my hope, is that even among a significant portion of the people who love Trump, they just get that feeling of, man, there's just always something with this guy. There's always something that just makes life harder for everybody else. That was the lesson of the 2022 midterms. That was the lesson of the last couple of years of his presidency at the minimum. That's the lesson of his role in the Republican Party today. And you can be like the overprotective mom who thinks, you know, it's really not his fault. He's a good boy. And, you know, it's society or whoever or the media that's given him a bad rap and all that kind of stuff. But Donald Trump is not your relative and you don't owe him that kind of latitude. He's just a dude who thinks very little of you, right? Particularly if you're ever critical of him, thinks very little of this country the moment it doesn't love him or doesn't do what he wants or doesn't make him the center of attention. So you just don't owe him this much loyalty, this much leeway. And I think that this Alvin Bragg stuff, not to mention the stuff coming down the pike, my hope is that for a lot of, you know, people who I know, you know, look, I mean, the people who are the biggest MAGA people on Twitter tend to be jerks because that's the performative incentive structure that Trump has created. But I just know, look, I have enough relatives and friends and people I've met and people I've talked to and I hear from who are not horrible people just because they like Donald Trump and don't see him the way I do. It bothers me that they don't see him something along the ways I do. It bothers me that they don't see what a con man and buffoon he is, but it doesn't make them bad people. And what I'm hoping is that enough of them go through all this, see this exhortation to violence or this winking and nodding at violence and say, you know, it's just too much muchness. Oh, that reminds me. Not last night, but two nights ago, I was on CNN. And this is a straight up ethical dilemma that I couldn't sort out on air live. I was doing a TV hit, the Aaron Burnett show. It's called Out Front, the 7 o'clock hour on CNN. And I was talking about some of this stuff. And I was talking about how, you know, Trump brings out the worst in people and, you know, and that the Bragg indictment, if it is as reported, is a perfect sign about how Trump's violation of norms invites violation of norms by others. And I said, so it's sort of a symptom of this broader era that we live in and of tit for tat, eye for an eye, politics as the crow flies. And Aaron is very nice, was like, that's just such a wonderful phrase. I'm going to steal that. I'll give you credit. But politics as the crow flies. And, you know, we were out of time and all this kind of stuff. And I just kind of sweated. Do I tell her that this is the title of a very famous essay from the British philosopher Michael Oakeshott and I didn't coin it? Or do I let her just give me credit for coining the phrase politics of the core flies? And I didn't correct her. I just want to be clear. I haven't heard from anybody. I was sure there'd be at least one Oakeshottian in the audience. And you'd be like, hey, wait a second. But I haven't heard from them if there was. And then at the end, I made another point about how there was too much muchness to Trump. And again, she said, oh, another great phrase. And I was like, I didn't do it again because that's actually a Britishism. It's not my phrase, but I feel bad about it. Because I don't like taking credit for other people's or whatever. You know what I mean? So I'm talking about CNN. So last night I was on the Anderson Cooper show with Van Jones in the 8 o'clock hour. And if you had told me not too long ago, I'd be chumming it up with Van Jones on TV. I would have been skeptical. That all went fine. And then, in the 10 o'clock hour, I did this, other show Allison Camerota was hosting, and it was funny. We all were basically fine talking about our different points of view on Trump and on this really terrible case about this Colorado couple who are being charged with some degree of manslaughter for their role in their son's killing spree in his high school. And we can talk about that in a second, I guess, since I brought it up. But then there was supposed to be this sort of light moment about how a West Texas A&M, the president of West Texas A&M, canceled or banned a drag show for charity, I think some fraternity or something. And everyone was just having so much fun talking about what an idiot the president of the school was. And look, his statement was a bit of a stretch. He compared it to blackface. He said, you know, drag shows are, you know, full of misogyny and blah, 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 blah. And he would never allow a drag show on his campus any more than he would allow a blackface show. And everyone was just dunking on this from great height and talking about how stupid this was. And, ooh, the dumb guy read an article and he didn't understand it. And now he's saying something stupid. And, you know, I just felt like, you know, what is my role here other than to be the skunk at the Guardian party on this? And so, as best I could, you know, everything went kind of fast. It's live TV, but I made the point that, look, I wouldn't compare it to blackface, although the blackface thing, you know, look, Rob Long had made this point in commentary. I think I made this point in a G-file at some point. You know, the blackface thing, I think, is fraught, and I wouldn't have brought it up in that context, but it is not as just sort of, oh, look at these idiots, they don't even know what blackface is, kind of stupid as some of the liberals on the panel were making it out to seem. You know, you think about, remember Rachel Dolezal? She's the white woman who identified as black and darkened her skin and kinked her hair to make it look like it was African-American hair. And she was vilified for it. You know, she was even the head of, either the Oregon State NAACP or at least a chapter in Oregon, maybe like the Portland NAACP. I think the people who just instantaneously think that the blackface thing is just on its face stupid should think about why it is that identifying as black is just simply taboo and impermissible in our culture as a matter of identity politics, but identifying as a woman, is, or a man, isn't. I totally agree. They're different things. And it's fine to say, well, they're different things. But do you know why they're different things? Can you explain it in a rational, coherent way that is consistent? And I don't think a lot of people can. And so anyway, I didn't get into that. But anyway, I said, you know, look, the blackface comparison, I wouldn't do. I probably wouldn't ban it. You know, it's for some charity and it's a fraternity and let them do what they want to do. But at the same time, I have no problem with presidents of universities. I don't know if West Texas A&M is, I assume it's a public university, but I was like, because A&M, but I don't know. And I was like, I have no problem with the heads of private universities setting standards for campuses that they're in charge of. And I have no problem with it with public universities. It's just, I understand that there are sort of different rules applied to public universities and private universities in terms of First Amendment protections and all the rest. And then I made this point that annoys a lot of people. And again, I think I probably did it too starkly, where I made this point that, you know, look, I think it's very weird in our culture, and I see this on Twitter all of the time, that you have to love, you know, it's sort of like, you know, you'll be made to care, right? It's sort of like, you know, you have to wear the ribbon. You have to love and celebrate drag shows in all their forms if you want to be on the right side of the transgender issue. And I mean, I use the right side advisedly, on the progressive side of the transgender issue. And that just bugs me. I just don't like it, right? I mean, I think drag shows for kids are just, particularly little kids, are just inappropriate. And certainly the worst case examples that I've seen are really, really inappropriate. And they would be inappropriate if they weren't drag queens, but actual women dancing and behaving the way they are. But this guy, Jay Michelson, he made the point that, you know, most drag shows aren't simulated strip shows. They're more like, you know, glamming things. And I guess that's true. And that's fine. The only drag shows I've been to were more like that, I guess. So like I say, show. At the same time, I don't have to celebrate it, right? And I don't have to think it's cool. And I think my point was, I think it's very weird. Like if I had said in the 1990s or early 2000s, if you don't like gay strip shows, then you're really not supportive of homosexuals in America. The gay people I knew would have, you know, torn me apart. You know, this idea that first of all, drag shows and the transgender issue, you know, they've been conflated, but you know, drag shows have a different cultural valence in America and in Western and in history than the sort of broader issues of transgenderism. But regardless, this idea that if you don't celebrate this flamboyant kind of performance thing, then you're not for equal rights and all these other things, I just don't buy it. And that made some people uncomfortable. But more broadly, I just was like, look, I might have reached different conclusions than this university president, but I have no problem with presidents of universities imposing standards or upholding standards for their institutions. And this this other guy I was with, I could not believe. I mean, he was a very nice guy, some lawyer, I never met him before, named Joey Jackson, who goes on this. He's a funny guy because almost everything he does is sort of, he sounds like he's giving either a press conference for his client or summarizing something in front of a jury. And I felt a little guiltier than usual interrupting him a couple times because he gets into this sort of musical kind of cadence about how he's making it, building up to his point and all that. But I think a lot of it is just, I don't want to say it's BS, but at one point I said, I thought what he was saying was ridiculous. He basically was making this full-throated argument that college is a laboratory of learning. That's his line. It's a laboratory of learning, and it's a place to be expressive, and you need to be able to express yourself. And who is the president of a university to tell students what to do in a laboratory of learning? And he goes on about this over, you know, it seemed like forever. Maybe it's just because I find the whole thing so, I reject the thing so much that it seemed longer than it was. But about this, you know, it's a place for expression. It's a place to discover who you are and protest and yada, yada, yada. And, And who has any right to judge or determine how other people should, you know, express themselves? And I was just like, I don't know, the president of a university? That's sort of his job. You know, like, I don't think students should be able to tell professors what's going to be on the curriculum or the syllabi. They don't get to vote on that. And he's like, they do get to vote. They vote with their spirit. And it was just like, oh my God, you know, and he keeps doing this. Who is this person to say what the right way to do things is? And then like, who appointed him? I was like, I don't know. The trustees of the university, they hired the guy. Now you can fire him if he makes a really bad decision. You know, institutions are supposed to make decisions about what members of that institution can and can't do. You know, again, we're talking about norms and customs and rules more than we're talking about laws, but still, you know, that's, you know, this is my, I didn't get into a whole Yuval Levin thing, but you know, this argument is that institutions are supposed to shape character. And they're supposed to bend people to the needs and the missions of the institution. And his sort of approach was, no, they're all Rousseauian noble savages who get to sort of define themselves as they go, and nobody has any authority over them. And I just think that's madness and bizarre madness. And I know it sounds good to a lot of people, but that's one of the problems with our culture, is how good it sounds to people.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
To get off of this for the time being, like the McKay-Coppins. I think, no, I'm sorry. It's not McKay-Coppins. Now I can't remember what his name is. But the guy from the Washington Post, kind of looks like McKay-Coppins. He was tweeting yesterday about what a huge generational divide it is over TikTok, and you're having a lot of old people decide what young people can do. And I saw this a bunch of places yesterday because of the TikTok hearings. I responded, you know, first of all, the Constitution kind of makes that inevitable, because I don't think you can be a Congress member until you're what, 25? Can't be a senator until you're 30 or 35? I can't remember. But regardless, there are age restrictions on being one of these decision makers. There are formal ones. There's also like civilizational ones, is that, you know, you get more authority and experience as you get older to make decisions for people who lack authority and experience. The idea that somehow, which was all over the place on Twitter and on cable news last night or yesterday, that young people will be mad at something and therefore the olds shouldn't do it, was everywhere. Look, I get the point. It's, as an analytical thing, it's objectively true. It's an observable fact. But that's also just how, like, civilization works, you know, and the idea that the problem with America, which is the least sort of deferential as a cultural matter to old people, of probably any advanced country in the world, or at least is up there, that somehow our problem is we don't listen to the young people enough, I just think is bizarre and stupid. I mean, I really do. And yeah, I do realize it's a little awkward right now that both parties are dominated by really, really old people. But that's not my preference. I would be perfectly happy to swap out, not necessarily sort of Logan's Run style, but I would be perfectly happy to swap out the entire highest quintile of old people with the next quintile tomorrow. You know, first of all, I think, you know, aging the baby boomers out of government service would be good for everybody. But I don't think aging in the zennials or whatever the youngest cohort, you know, the 18 to 25 year olds, I don't think that they should be put in charge either. But like this, I mean, I know I'm a broken record on this. I've written so much about it. But the deification of youth in our culture, particularly on the progressive left, but it's got its own version on the right. It's just not as strong. It's getting stronger. You know, the number of people who think like Turning Point USA is a really valuable and important driver of American politics seems to grow by the day and grows stronger by the day. But it's really among on the left. There has always been this notion that somehow if you could just take the passion of young people and have it override American politics, everything would be awesome. I made a lot of hay back in the day that wasn't intended to rhyme about Hillary Clinton's line in It Takes a Village, where she says, some of the wisest theologians I've ever met have been five-year-olds. No, they haven't. you know, this is just, it's just gobbledygook garbage. And look, I get it. The whole book was, what did PJ say about it? It was like written from the national, from the pages of the Tales of Hallmark Cardia or something like that. I get the point, you know, kids have this certain kind of visitor from Mars, seeing the world fresh point of view. But this idea that somehow kids, that young people are inherently wiser than old people is so ridiculous. And I want to be clear, I was an old young person. Like I was making this point when I was a Gen Xer, when leaning into your Gen X stuff leaning into your youth was a great way to skip a lot of hurdles in getting jobs from baby boomers. Because one of the great examples of damage that baby boomers have done to the United States of America is their wild emphasis, nostalgia-driven emphasis on the glory and wonders of youth politics. So anyway, that gets me back to this CNN thing. There's this idea that this guy, Joey Jackson was making, that college is supposed to be this place where you let your freak flag fly, right? And that's how you sort of, you know, it's supposed to be a place where you discover yourself and all that. And I get it. Look, I discovered a lot about myself in college. I'm not poo-pooing that entirely. But this gets at my sort of longstanding. I was talking about this the other day on the AMA remnant. Administrators at elite universities in particular, but not just elite universities, have made this, I think, disastrous assumption that a key part of the college experience, the thing that makes college college, is protesting. They've institutionalized this idea of radical rejection of the powers that be, of standing. You know, it's funny, William F. Buckley gets all this grief for saying standing athwart history, yelling stop, when in fact that is like the core insight of huge swaths of the radical progressive left, particularly when it comes to climate change stuff. I mean, what is Greta Thunberg yelling if not stop, you know? Stop to fossil fuels, stop to economic growth. I believe she's saying stop to wind farms, too. I mean, she's a classic radical in the sense that radicalism means tearing things down to the roots. The whole stop the world I want to get off thing is much more, I shouldn't say it's much more a thing of the left. I think it's a part of the problem. I think there's a problem on the right, too, with this kind of thinking. But it's not what Buckley was talking about. Buckley was talking about a specific sort of direction of politics and public philosophy that he wanted to stand athwart and yell stop at. A lot of these people want to yell stop at the warp and woof of Western civilization. So anyway, my point is getting back to this radicalism thing. You have it sort of written into the DNA of these universities that walkouts, protests. Let's all sign a petition. Let's boo visiting speakers, that this is what college is all about. And if you didn't have this kind of experience in college, you didn't have the full college experience. And again, I think it is in part a legacy of the baby boomers who have, you know, whose nostalgia has warped every institution in America. I'm not saying every baby boomer, but I'm talking about the elite baby boomers who did the long march through the institutions, Gramsci style, in the 60s. They have left their indelible mark on the culture and character of these institutions. And it just sort of takes for granted that you're supposed to be raising rebels. And you've heard me talk a million times around here about how the sort of inherent contradiction of this whole thing is that the psychology that they're infecting these kids with is actually radical conformity, but the pill goes down with this coding that tells them that they're all rebels. And I think it's a terrible approach to education. I think, you know, we would be a much better country if we had a lot less of that and a lot more of, I don't know, like, you know, 19th century British education, where everybody was taught to sit in rows and memorize things and be able to explain what they memorized, than, you know, this riot of self-expression stuff. So again, I don't know that the president of West Texas A&M made the right decision about this drag show. I hadn't really heard about the story till I went on TV yesterday, but I have no problem with the heads of institutions making decisions about the nature of their institution and what is going to be permissible or not permissible there. And it's funny, I got into this argument with this other guy. He seems like a very nice guy. I mean, he's a rabbi and writes, I guess, for the Daily Beast. Jay Michelson, liked him. I mean, I sincerely liked him. I think he's very smart. Made plenty of fine points. But he accused me of being part of cancel culture and endorsing cancel culture. And, like, I don't necessarily know what he means by cancel culture. But if you define cancel culture as the ability of the stewards of institutions who are responsible for making meaningful decisions about the direction and nature of those institutions, having the power and the authority to do so and to be held accountable for bad decisions. Yeah. If that's the definition of cancel culture, I'm for cancel culture. But, you're not really supposed to talk about what you talk about during commercial breaks and stuff. So I'll make my point rhetorically. The consensus was on the panel that the blackface comparison was terrible and stupid. I am perfectly fine with, for the sake of argument, conceding that point here, and I'm probably fine with conceding the substance of it, whatever. So let's just stipulate it. But I would ask people who, you know, think it's outrageous for a school to cancel a drag show, would you think it's outrageous for a school to cancel a minstrel show with blackface? And my assumption is the answer is no, you'd think it's fine. So, and that's fine. Like, if I were the president of a university, I would say you can't do that either. That doesn't mean I'm in favor of cancel culture. That means I have some minimal standard about the kind of character that we're going to inculcate around here. And that, you know, again, I talked about this on the Solo Remnant, but like the Stanford thing, I just think is a perfect example of this where, you know, the philosophy that says you should be able to just sort of express yourself without consequence, express yourself through improper channels and at improper times in improper ways without consequence, is the kind of philosophy that gets you things like the disaster at Stanford. And again, like and it's particularly bad because this is Stanford Law School, right? Which is fundamentally a vocational school. It is teaching people how to do a specific job. And if the reports are accurate, I have yet to see any pushback on it. The reports are accurate that students in the hallway shouted or whispered or hissed obscenities at a sitting federal judge, including, "I hope your daughters get raped." They should be expelled. And if not expelled, certainly suspended, right? But they shouldn't be celebrated. They shouldn't be like, "Oh, you spoke truth to power." No, you behaved like an idiot. tell me, I got listeners all over the place. I got listeners, you know, who work on Capitol Hill. I got listeners who work in corporate America, work in law firms that are stay at home, you know, parents. I got listeners in every walk of life. I got student listeners. Fine. What walk of life do you live in where if somebody said that, if some trainee said that to a visiting dignitary, would there be no repercussions for it? Really? Are you, you're the assistant manager at Jiffy Lube? And one of the trainees says to a client who comes in, I hope your daughters get raped. You'd be okay with that? You'd be okay with that in the faculty lounge? You'd be okay with that in your law firm, at your bank, at your church? It is just, it has nothing to do with free speech stuff to me. It has to do with, you know, knowing what proper behavior is and what the proper functioning of an institution is. It's, as Yuval always says, the first question you should ask in any institution is, what is my role here? And teaching kids who have to become, presumably a large number of them, officers of either, if you're going to law school, you know, the handful of you who aren't going to be script writers, you're either going to be a lawyer, which means you're going to be an officer of the court, where you're going to have to deal with opposing counsel or your own clients who you might think are terrible people. And talking like that is just a non-starter. Never mind talking to a judge in court like that. You'll go to jail for contempt. And if you're not going to become a lawyer of some kind, you're going to become a law professor of some kind. And teaching kids that kind of behavior is tolerable and acceptable or laudatory is outrageous as well. And so, like, this is the kind of thing you reap when you sow this idea that there should be no constraints and no authority has any right to tell you how to conduct yourself, including in the institution that authority is in charge of. Now, at the same time, I'm wildly in favor of free speech on college campuses and other places, but free speech rightly understood, free speech, you know, for free inquiry, free speech for political protest, free speech for freedom of conscience and freedom of religion. All of these things are fine, or not even fine. They're glorious and need to be protected, but but, you know, these schools have honor codes, most of them, or they're supposed to. And they're supposed to, people are supposed to have good manners and live with decorum. And you can ask anything you want in a Q&A. You can ask anything you want through the right channels and whatnot. But being a jackass for its own sake does not seem to me to be something that we should celebrate. And imposing authority within institutions is not something that we should sort of have this knee-jerk, oh, that's ridiculous attitude towards. So anyway, I should go on about all of this stuff, but I actually have to return to one of my favorite advertisers, and that's, of course, Fire. I should also say, you know, on this point about, like, enforced conformity, it is one of my great frustrations is this sort of Mott and Bailey argument that says when conformity is enforced, when the sort of mob campus culture is enforced, that's free speech. But when meaningful dissent against that mob mentality, that mob monopoly on discourse occurs, that's seen as provoking violence or being hurtful or spreading hate. It is amazing how the language and psychological, you know, mechanisms of the enforced conformity on college campuses has adopted the language of free speech in a way that allows them to minimize the actual free speech of meaningful academic freedom, meaningful dissent from enforced conformity. And that's why I want to talk to you about Fire. Do you value free speech, individual rights, and academic freedom? then I have something important to tell you. The Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, aka FIRE, is a staunchly nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that fights for your right to express your opinions without fear of censorship or retaliation. FIRE publishes a weekly newsletter called FIRE Update. Each update covers the latest developments in free speech and individual rights. It exposes censorship on campus and in communities, highlights free speech victories, and offers readers opportunities to participate in the conversation. By subscribing, you'll join a diverse community of individuals who are like-minded in their commitment to free expression. So what are you waiting for? Head to thefire.org/update. That's thefire, T-H-E-F-I-R-E. .org/update, or click the link in the episode description and subscribe to the FIRE Update today. Your voice matters, and with FIRE on your side, you can help protect the rights that keep our society free. All right, so I don't know what I'm going to write about today. My whole schedule in New York got blown up. I had all sorts of things I needed to do, but and I don't know if I can. I don't, this is not your problem. You don't need to know about my itinerary. So there was this tweet a couple of weeks ago now, or a week ago. I can't even remember. It was in response to Ron DeSantis' statement about Ukraine, you know, that he gave as part of his answer to a questionnaire from Tucker Carlson. And Andrew Sullivan made the point that DeSantis' position was considered something, I don't have the tweet in front of me, but the normie position, as in normal position under Obama just a few years ago. And now people are freaking out as if it's sort of radical and unacceptable. And I've been thinking about this a lot. I think Andrew's got a point. I also think Andrew misses a huge point here insofar as I didn't like Obama's foreign policy. I thought it was very bad. I said so at the time, and I don't see why I should change my view about, you know, quote unquote, foreign policy realism and multilateralism and leading from behind and all those other things simply because they have been imbibed by certain parts of the Republican Party. I thought Andrew fell pretty hard for Obama after he broke his support for George W. Bush, became a big defender of Barack Obama. And that was fine. Like, Andrew's a smart guy. He's allowed to defend a politician that he thinks is worth defending. He's certainly allowed to rebel against, as many people did, his early support for the Iraq War, given how the Iraq War went. We should talk about that for a second. So I'm not saying his position was illegitimate or anything like that. I just disagreed with it. You know, I had a lot of positions back then he disagreed with. I have a lot of positions now he probably disagrees with. Point I'm trying to make is that it kind of shows you how partisanship, not on Andrew's part, because his point was, he was making a point about how, you know, the left was going crazy about stuff that they used to believe. And I think he's right about that. But it does sort of show you more broadly how sort of tribal partisanship makes it so difficult to hold a straight line on any of these things. DeSantis' statement, and we're going to get to the fact that DeSantis has since tried to clean it up, which I think vindicates my points in a lot of ways. But, you know, DeSantis' statement, it's just a territorial dispute. We have no interest in getting further in this. We don't want boots on the ground. You know, the whole thing, I was probably a little too harsh on it at the outset because I was letting the territorial dispute eclipse everything else. But as I think I said on the Dispatch podcast last week, I think the real takeaway from that DeSantis statement was that it was just a mistake. It was a mistake because he tried to be all things to all people. He tried to split the baby. A bunch of people made this point that it was just a political statement trying to keep all various constituencies, quote unquote, on side, as the Brits like to say, and therefore pleased almost nobody except the reflex defenders of Ron DeSantis. I think it was a mistake for him to think he had to answer the question for Tucker Carlson. I think it's turning out that maybe the DeSantis' biggest analytical problem and understanding the lay of the land in politics is that he's just way too addicted to Twitter, is way too online, and is surrounded by people who care too much about Twitter, and is hiring people who care way too much about Twitter, and he's taking their advice. I think that has led him to sort of snuggle up to a lot of the Claremont types, which I think is a huge mistake for him. Just getting back to the sort of the, so like, you know, whenever it was that Andrew tweeted this thing, I made this point. It's like, well, what if I disliked Obama's foreign policy too, and I dislike it when it comes from a Republican? And all these people, I mean, this is one of these really annoying things about the life I have chosen, but also it's accentuated on Twitter, is that I will often say, I don't like this, or I don't like that. And somebody will say, well, you didn't say it when so-and-so did it. And the matter of fact is, I did say it when so-and-so did it. These people just didn't read it, don't remember it, or didn't look for it, or don't care. They're just trying to make this point that somehow I am the one who's being opportunistic and partisan, when it's actually their response that's opportunistic and partisan. And I got it from enough people because of that tweet thing that I went back and looked. I wrote cover stories for National Review about Barack Obama's, foreign policy and why I didn't like it. You know, I from his, campaign speech in Berlin, which was always freaking weird, man. He had this huge rally campaign speech in Berlin. Imagine if Donald Trump had campaigned in Berlin. His whole thing about how walls are bad and borders are bad and separation is bad and we need to knock down these things. And it was all super, super globalist, but, you know, globalist in the sort of multilateral institution kind of way. And he had the same approach to foreign policy that he had to domestic policy, which is that he thought he understood his opponent's interests better than they did. He was a big devotee of the exact, or one of the exact kinds of foreign policy realism that I've heaped scorn on for 20 years now, and which I did quite often under the Obama presidency. Anyway, so like, you know, I went back and looked, and the part, again, I think that the problem with DeSantis' statement wasn't that he was actually laying out a robust, isolationist, non-interventionist America First position. It's that he wanted to sound like he was to the non-interventionist and America First types while sounding like he wasn't to the supporters of the Ukraine war, or supporters of aiding Ukraine, and sort of the more hawkish people. And he ended up doing neither. But which gets me to this thing about how it was, you know, a mistake. He realized it was a mistake. He cleaned it up in this Piers Morgan interview and said, you know, it was misinterpreted, blah, 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 blah. Because the closer you looked at it, the more you realized he wasn't saying very much. I mean, you had to get really lawyerly and analyze it in a sort of, okay, what is this actually, what binding power would this have over a President DeSantis? And it's like literally none. Even the territorial dispute thing was arguably too clever by, you know, arguably was an attempt to describe a hypothetical rather than the reality. I mean, that's being a little generous, I think, to DeSantis. It turns out that he had to clean it up. And I think that gets to my point that it was a mistake in the first place, because he misread what the reaction was going to be to it. I think the first mistake, was thinking that he had to dance to friggin' Tucker Carlson's tune. He could have ignored Tucker Carlson's questionnaire. I mean, it may be that they have such a personal relationship that, you know, Tucker called him and said, you got to do this. And he didn't think it was worth kind of like blowing up the, you know, the future free airtime he might get. Taking it, I mean, like, Tucker's had advice for me that I rejected because I knew it wasn't actually in my interest. The idea that like Tucker's primary interest is in doing what's right for the GOP or right for Ron DeSantis is something I think the DeSantis team is going to have to get over, and eventually it's going to learn. You know, there are some people who are just not going to be the kinds of team players that you think they're going to be. Yes. Anyway, I think that the kind of, you know, look, people misuse and again, this is something I've been writing about for 20 years. People misuse isolationism all the time. Isolation is one of these scare words that is never the, it's like the censorship thing or the cancel culture thing, right? Like we all agree that having blackface minstrel show on campus is something a president of a university should cancel, but we're not going to call that cancel culture. We all believe that grotesque, hardcore pornography on TV should be censored, but we're just not going to call that censorship. Isolationism is almost never something that people use to describe themselves. It's almost always something people use to describe people they don't like. In that sense, it's the opposite of realism, where everybody calls themselves a realist and says these, it's the other people who aren't realists. But isolationism, look, I'm not a fan of Rand Paul. I'm really not a fan of his dad. And those guys come closer to sort of traditional American isolationism than many, but they're still free traders. And I remember Ron Paul in one of the debates talking about how he was against a border wall because the problem with border walls is that they can be built to keep people out, but pretty soon they're meant to keep people in. Dum, 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 right? There are aspects of internationalism to almost everybody who ever gets called a isolationist. And there are elements of isolationism to everybody who gets called internationalist. Again, this is it's like the paranoid style in American politics. It's always decried as a right-wing phenomenon when it is actually an American phenomenon. It's actually a universal human phenomenon where there's lots of paranoid style on the left. Similarly, there's a long history of isolationism on the left. McGovern ran for president on the slogan, in part, "Come home, America." What's his face? Was it William Fulbright, who was Bill Clinton's mentor for a while, was a sort of crazy moral equivalence with the Soviet Union jackass on foreign policy stuff and very much an isolationist in many meaningful ways. FDR, you know, who is seen as the ultimate enemy of isolationists, you know, until World War II was much more isolationist than I would like. You know, he's the one who pulled out of the world economic crisis in 36, was one of his key decisions that lengthened the Great Depression because he wanted America to go its own way on economic recovery. It was economically speaking, it was one of the most isolationist things in American history. When I was growing up politically in the 1990s, it was Dick Gephardt and the Democrats who were the protectionists. And it was the Republicans like Phil Graham who were the free traders. And so anyway, I think the isolationism thing gets wildly overused and misused. But non-interventionism is much more of a thing, right? Dovishness is much, I mean, no one likes to call themselves a dove, but, you know, but I think it's a fairer term because at least it's graded on the curve of the existing context, right? We know what the situation is right now, that the person, the group or faction that is most opposed to any military intervention is going to be the dove camp in the same way that the group most in favor of intervention is going to be the hawk camp. Now, what defines hawkishness or what defines dovishness will change given the context, but I think it's a fine word or fine adjective to use, at least conversationally for things. But, you know, interventionism, non-interventionism, internationalism, these are better terms. You know, protectionist is a perfectly fine term to use, I think. Although, again, lots of people, you know, just don't, will not own the labels that, no one will own the labels that unfairly apply to them. Very few, but a lot of people won't even own the labels that fairly apply to them. And so anyway, I think that the strain in Republican politics these days of non-interventionism of, you know, I saw the other night, I don't watch it, but I saw a clip, Tucker mocking people as sort of a sheep, you know, who say that Putin's a war criminal. Putin's a war criminal. I mean, that's just freaking obvious. And it's I don't really think it's a debatable proposition at this point. It's both objectively true and normatively true and legally true at this point. But the attitude towards foreign policy these days on the right, I think if you were a visitor from Mars or if you've been asleep for 10 years, this just gets me back to Andrew's point, you'd say, wow, the big chunk of the Republican Party has basically adopted not so much Obama's foreign policy, because Obama loved the UN and loved multilateral institutions and all that kind of stuff. He just wanted to lead from behind. He wanted those institutions as part of, the global order kind of thing. And I don't mean in a conspiratorial sense. He wanted, other institutions and our allies to take more of the heat and more of the responsibility off of our plate. That's not quite the foreign policy non-interventionism that is on the right. It's much more of a Fortress America kind of approach. But this sort of just sort of general animosity towards the idea that America has an interest in being the leader of the free world, of maintaining the global order, of maintaining our alliances, of asserting its principles on a global stage. It seems to me that I know I'm struggling with this, and I apologize for people who've just stopped jogging and started yelling, spit it out, Jonah. But part of the thing about these weird podcasts I do is I think out loud, and sometimes I need to take a second and think. I think one of the things that Donald Trump has done to the GOP is he has made the decline in civilizational confidence bipartisan. A lot of Democratic foreign policy going back to the Vietnam era really rests, if not even earlier in the Cold War, rests on this sort of fundamentally screwed up lack of self-confidence that says, who are we to tell other countries how to live? Who are we to say we're the leader of the free world? Who are we to say that, what's right and wrong? Sort of like the argument the guy was making about college presidents. There's that argument on the left, the sort of San Francisco Democrat speech that Gene Kirkpatrick gave, the Blame America First crowd. There's an aspect of that that has now become utterly bipartisan. And this sort of gets into, on Wednesday, I responded to Stephen Miller, who took offense at my criticisms of Donald Trump's idiotic speech last week, where he was talking about how the greatest threat to Western civilization are the godless Marxists and globalists in America who want to destroy America and prevent me from becoming president, yada, yada, yada. Admittedly, it comes from a different psychological place. But, Trump's view of America is America. It's amazing how America can be this great and glorious place when he is president. But the second someone other than him runs it, it is a laughingstock. It is pathetic. It is the joke. It's a disaster. America was great, was a great and good country when Barack Obama was president. I think he didn't do as much as some people claim he did to make it a better country. And then in some ways, I think he made it a worse country, but it was still a great country, still a good country. We're a good people. And we have got a heritage and a tradition and ideals and principles that we should not be ashamed of. We should actually proselytize as best we can within reason and all the rest. But for Trump, America is only great when he's at the helm. And when it sticks up for its principles, it's being a sucker. And our leader, this is a point Yuval made years ago, that Trump's critique of the U.S., of the United States and of the U.S. government is different than prior conservative critiques. Prior conservative critiques were that elites, that progressive elites, that the government was too powerful and was too clever in its social engineering and bossing us around and all that kind of stuff. And Trump's critique was that it was stupid and weak and that it needed to be stronger and tougher and smarter, as just like him, obviously. But that's not the traditional conservative complaint about government, is that, it's really dumb and really weak. It's that it's, you can say that some of the policies were dumb, and we certainly did a lot of that. But it was that, it's run by very clever people who are trying to manipulate us and try to nudge us and cajole us and socially engineer us, and that it's too strong. And that was not Trump's critique. And Trump's critique, you know, to this day is America without me in charge is a joke and pathetic and horrible. And that too, I mean, this sounds very much like Kevin Williamson stuff. That too is a sort of right-wing version of the progressive idolatry of government and particularly of the presidency. You know, it is a vision that says the presidency is really like a monarchy. And if you have a good king, the country is healthy and happy. And if you have a bad king, the country isn't. That point of view basically is something the conservatives for decades criticized, this idea that the president is the captain of the ship and runs the country and creates jobs with a job creation machine in the basement. Trump shares that progressive point of view. He adorns it with all sorts of right-wing batshittery, but it's the same basic approach to the role of government. And how did I get on this? Oh, so anyway, like if you, my problem with the Trump speech last week, which I think obviously Steve Miller wrote, which is why he got his panties in a bunch about it, is that it's, I mean, you can go back and read it. If you were a subscriber, you can go back and read it. I got a lot of nice reaction to it. It works from the assumption, like so much of this Trump stuff does, that because Trump says these words about being America, making America great, and patriotism and the Constitution and the Bible and all these kinds of things, first of all, it first of all assumes that he means any of it. You know, and the idea that Trump believes any of the stuff he says about Christianity or religion or God or the Bible, I mean, at what point do you just sort of like have to have a crisis of conscience about your ability to be conned if you still believe any of that stuff? It's just so laughably pathetic and stupid, the idea that like he's a serious Christian. Hell, I mean, there are people out there who are saying he's like Jesus, which is just, you know, Japanese game show crazy. But let's just say for the benefit of the doubt and be charitable that he does believe all of this stuff. What evidence is there that he is actually a person suited to doing anything about the problems that he identifies? What evidence is there that he actually won't make a lot of the problems that he's pointing to worse? Anyway, there's a deep and passionate anti-Americanism to Trump's pro-America stuff and to the right's pro-America stuff, because it, first of all, assumes that that the United States of America is first and last an expression of the partisan priorities of the partisan policy priorities of a specific political party at a given moment of time. And I'm sorry for all the alliteration there. You know, if the Republicans are in power, America's a good country. If the Republicans aren't in power, America's a bad country is not an argument to say that we're a good country. It is a banana republic argument. There's a deeply, deeply, deeply unpatriotic thing going on when you say that our biggest enemies, the biggest threat to America are other Americans. Now, I think, as I wrote about, you know, there's a superficially plausible defense of some of that insofar as I've talked and written a lot about how ingratitude is bad and is suicidal for Western civilization, for the United States of America, that anti-Americanism is incredibly dangerous and misguided and wrong and could lead to the dissolution of a lot of the things that I hold dear. I agree with all of that. But the answer to that is not to say that our existential enemies are other Americans. It is not to say that America should be a country at war, not with some evil foreign power, but with other Americans. That is not the way out of any of this. And what drove me crazy about the Trump speech was that he was trying to make the argument that supporting Ukraine, again, we're not talking about sending troops, right? We're not talking about American boots on the ground. We're talking about sending some tanks and some bullets and some guns. One of the things I criticized the Obama foreign policy for was that, you know, there was this great line in the Wall Street Journal. It was 10, 15 years ago, 12 years ago now, 10 years ago, about how when I was talking to some American general, I think, about how if Russia complies with our demands, we won't supply the Ukraines with more provisions. But if Russia violates our terms, then we are going to release the socks, because we were sending socks to the Ukrainians, not weapons. But anyway, so Trump's position, and to the extent that DeSantis was trying to mimic it or sound like he was mimicking it, DeSantis's position in that statement was that we should consider that because Russia isn't the greatest threat to Western civilization, we shouldn't consider it a threat to civilization at all. Now, I'm not the one who brought up Western civilization in this context. It was Trump who did. But like, I thought he was America first guy, not a civilization first guy. And the question, you know, that the American first guys always say, you know, the smart ones at least say, is, you know, it's about putting our interests first. And so the question, you know, the whole framing, the way Trump does this is not to say we is to, when it comes to Russia, he just puts the question of interests completely aside. And, you know, it's a perfectly rational thing to say, okay, you know, to ask, is it in our interest to help Ukraine? And I, for the life of me, do not see the arguments about what, well, I shouldn't say that. I do see some of the arguments of why it isn't in the interests of the United States to help Ukraine. I just don't see enough of them to outweigh all of the arguments in favor of sending some more tanks and guns and bullets to help the Ukrainians beat back the Russians. And to say that Russia isn't the greatest threat to American to Western civilization is fine, because it happens to be true. But that doesn't mean it isn't a threat to Western civilization. China isn't the greatest threat to Western civilization either, but there are very few Trumpy conservatives who don't want to like be more confrontational with China. Well, why? If it's a binary thing that if you're not the greatest threat to American to Western civilization, you're not a threat at all, then why should we care about China at all? Because according to Trump, the greatest threat are, you know, all of these jackwads who wear, you know, who put signs in their front yards that say, in this house, we believe science is real or whatever. That those are the real threats, to the only threat to Western civilization. And the only way to defeat those people is to elect Donald Trump, because he is our retribution, remember? And so anyway, I think that the way that Trump talks about and Trumpists talk about America isn't a pro-America approach. I mean, I mean that in the broadest sense possible. It is, I mean, I don't mean that it's just not good for America. I mean, it doesn't think much of America. And I want to be really consistent on this. I want to be clear about this. I'm really consistent on this point. I got a lot of heat. I don't know, what was it? Gosh, 17 years ago, whenever Dinesh came out with that book, The Enemy at Home. This was back when I still had much warmer feelings towards Dinesh. But I didn't like the book. Almost nobody liked the book, because at its core, it was a very bad argument. But anyway, the Claremont Review of Books, which I also used to have a much warmer feeling towards back then, asked me to review it, and I did. And the argument I made was that, so I should say, Dinesh's argument was that the American right should find common cause with the Islamist, quote unquote, right, with Islamist conservatives around the world, because we both sides share an appreciation for traditional values, traditional, you know, marriage, all this kind of stuff. And our real enemies are people like, I don't know, Britney Spears or something, and the cultural left. And I remember writing, I was like, look, you know, when it comes to this kind of thing, I'm pretty Irish. And you can go find the review. I mean, I haven't looked at it in 15 years, so I'm truly just paraphrasing. But I remember writing something along the lines of, you know, look, when it comes to this kind of stuff, you know, it brings out the Irish in me, insofar as I'm allowed to criticize my uncle. I'm allowed to criticize, you know, in this case, Ted Kennedy. But if you want to kill Ted Kennedy, you got to go through me, figuratively speaking, obviously. And what I mean by that is like, as bad as I think our domestic opponents are in the political realm, they're still my tribe. They're still my fellow countrymen. They're still Americans. And I'll be damned if I'm going to like be part of a international movement that says that I have more, I should have more loyalty to and affinity for people who hate this country, hate its regime, hate its constitution, hate its values, hate its history, because they like traditional marriage and are purportedly, you know, religiously conservative. That's just not how it's going to work for me, at least. And I don't think it's the way it's going to work for a lot of people. And he, you know, he found common cause with some truly terrible Islamist radicals because they agreed with his critiques of America's cultural left. And I'm just a hard pass on that kind of thinking. And it's funny, it hadn't occurred to me until just now, but like, it's kind of interesting how, you know, Dinesh was premature in his argument because we're now seeing some of that kind of thinking come out of, certainly, you know, people like Sohrab and Rod Dreher and others who like have this newfound sympathy for, from the excerpts I've seen of stuff that they've written of Islamist types rejecting Western cultural hegemony and all of that. It's actually not a bad piece for someone to do. I got to think about that. And the sort of, let's look to Hungary as a, or for that matter, in some parts, let's look to Putin as ideological comrades in our struggle with our domestic opponents is very much a what Dinesh was arguing 15 years ago. And I just utterly reject it. And I think it is a sort of a fundamentally anti-American, un-American way of thinking about things because it seems to think that we have more in common with a traditionalist in Hungary who wants to conserve a very different set of institutions and concepts than we do with fellow Americans. And it is a tendency that I've criticized for years about people on the left who want to, I've been accused of anti-Semitism for saying that, you know, the project of the American left for 100 years has been to Europeanize American politics. And I can give you chapter and verse on why I think that's absolutely and sort of irrefutably true. But I dislike it on the right too. And if you think that like the warp and woof and richness of American culture, can be erased because you have a D after your name or you have an R after your name, or because you pulled the lever in one of our countless elections for somebody that you don't like, then you really don't think much of American culture and much of the American history or American heritage or American character. I love this country. I love this country when Democrats are in charge. I love this country when Donald Trump was in charge. I haven't really, you know, been psyched about who's running, you know, the federal government in a really long time. It hasn't made me love this country less. And I think that people sort of lose sight of this as they make politics much, much more important than it should be. Anyway, I know I've gone really long. I can't count how many times I've said to myself, my God, I never really got to the point, did I? So I apologize. I gotta write a G file and figure out, you know, how I'm going to escape from New York. But thanks for listening. Thanks again to Fire for sponsoring today's episode of The Remnant. And you should go to www.thefire.org/update. I don't even know if you have to put the www in there. I just felt like saying it. But go to thefire.org/update and tell them I sent you. And I'll talk to you next time.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.